Good morning, everyone. All right, let's take two. Good morning, everyone. All right, that's what I'm talking about. All right, we are very fortunate today to have as our research plenary speaker, Dr. Tom Insel. We've had an all-star team of scientific presentations, and Tom Insel has been remarkable in that he has helped to create many of their careers. So I won't be talking about him as a mentor and a creator of other scientists that you've seen. I'll be introducing him to you briefly. NAMI, we need better treatments, and we need better understanding of the neuroscience roots of the causes of these conditions. I don't think anybody has been more committed to that mission than Dr. Tom Insel, who has become a tremendous friend to NAMI in our quest to connect research money to the public health burden that are people living with serious mental illness and the disability and vulnerability that they live with. The recovery story is also true, and it's true every day, and until we understand more about the neuroscience and the research that underlies better treatments, we will always be working upstream. Tom Insel is the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, I am very happy to say, which is the component of the National Institute of Health charged with generating knowledge to understand, treat, and prevent mental disorders. He has written over 280 papers, so I don't think he has a lot of hobbies, so I won't be discussing his hobbies in detail. Some groundbreaking things have happened under Dr. Insel's leadership, and I look forward to a long question and answer session. One of the great things about Dr. Insel is he wants to hear from NAMI, so there will be plenty of time for questions at the end of his talk, which is kind of great to be able to just ask the director of the National Institute of Mental Health any question you want. Dr. Tom Insel, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ken. Well, good morning. This is really a terrific meeting, and it's always a delight. I had to miss last year. I was with you in Seattle, and I think almost every other year that I've been in the job, which has been going on for a while, and it's always a highlight of the year. And as Ken said, part of what makes it special is I get to hear from you. And that is, there's always interesting questions, but always fantastic comments. I think it was actually Ken who once said to me, you know, in Massachusetts, where he's from, it's actually easier to get into Harvard Medical School than it is to get a bed in the state system, which, and I thought that's a great soundbite, but I'm sure it's not right. I actually did this. I looked it up. I ran the numbers, and you're right. It's a fantastic observation. Not a happy one, but it's it is worth reminding, especially physicians, about that. But actually, to be honest, my favorite NAMI moment was when I first began at NIMH. And Gemma Weiblinger, who's here and who works with me, had me meet with members of the NAMI board, which is really a great experience. And Mary, it'll be good to actually think about doing that again, sort of on a regular basis. But one of the board members, when they came in, I sort of said, you know, what can I do to help? What would be useful? And one of the board members, Joyce Berland, who is here, I think, at least is here at the meeting. Yeah, she said, well, here's an idea. Why don't you declare a day of atonement? And I thought, that's a really cool idea. But I didn't do it. And I ran into her a couple of nights ago here at the meeting, and I said, and we were recounting that. And I said, I'm so glad you mentioned that. And she said to me, yeah, I should have made it a week. So it has always been wonderful to hear from all of you and to hear what you're thinking about and what you feel would be useful. Here's what I'd like to do, and I do want to leave quite a bit of time for us to have a conversation. But first, let me take you through some thoughts about science and about how we go on this quest for the cure. But really what I'm going to run through with you are sort of what I call four inconvenient truths. And maybe that's not the best way to say it, but it's one way of, I think, forcing us to address some things that maybe are we don't like to talk about, but we have to talk about them if we're going to overcome these particular challenges. And these are challenging times and difficult issues. But I want to start by reminding you of something we tend not to talk about enough, and that is the success stories that we have seen based on biomedical research. And they are extraordinary. And I'll just run through a few very quickly. If you look, and this is measuring success by reductions in mortality, which is a pretty strong endpoint. So if you look here at one of the most common, well, the most common form of cancer in children, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, 30 or 40 years ago, that was fatal over 90% of the time in within 6 months. It's the most common cancer of children, with about 6,000 cases a year. Today, it's 90% of the time cured. Amazing. That's an amazing fact that we just don't talk about enough, and it's not unique. If you look at cardiovascular disease, far more common, one of the largest killers still in this country, and yet it is far less fatal than it was just 35 years ago. We've had a 65% reduction in mortality from heart disease. And again, that's the kind of fact that people don't celebrate or they're not apparently aware of. There are 1.1 million deaths averted every year in this country because of what we've learned from the Framingham Heart Study, from various studies about the effects of diet, lifestyle, and even medications on reducing cardiovascular death. AIDS, of course, is one that you probably do know more about, a 50% reduction in mortality there, just since the advent of antiretrovirals and some better public health measures. That's over about the last 20 years. And that has gotten to the point where this year in January, so just 9 months ago, the Department of Health and Human Services declared AIDS to be a chronic disease, something which just 15 years ago would have been unimaginable. Someone who gets infected today at the age of 20 is going to die of other causes in their 70s. That's amazing. That is, if they stay on medication and they take antiretrovirals. Even for brain disorders, we have a reduction in mortality from stroke of about 30%. And if you can get into an emergency room within 3 hours, you're going to leave the emergency room without any sequela. You'll basically, if you get clot-busting drugs, you can walk out. That's almost a miracle from where we were a decade ago. So we've got some extraordinary success stories, but the piece that we have to focus on for everybody in this room is the part that's not such a success story yet. So the rates of suicide have largely been unchanged. If anything, they're sort of drifting up over the last 20 years. This is the very same time when we've seen these other sources of mortality come down so strikingly. And as all of you know, at least 90% of the time when we talk about suicide, we're talking about death from a mental illness. What makes the suicide numbers especially uncomfortable for us is that we realize that other kinds of mortality associated with violence, like homicide, have come down. In fact, they've come down about 50%. Traffic fatalities have come down about 40% and actually are now less common or less prevalent than death from suicide. The most recent numbers, 39,000, a report out yesterday from the World Health Organization, 800,000 suicide deaths a year in the world. That's just an incredible global figure. 800,000, it's amazing. And there are 20 times more suicide attempts. So these are phenomenal public health numbers. And we have yet to bend this curve. That's really very striking when you see these kinds of numbers. It isn't, of course, just mortality that we're concerned with. We're concerned with disability, and if you haven't seen these numbers, they should be in every one of the brochures that we put out because they're really important. the most recent assessment of disability from all medical causes and injuries, so this is 291 diseases. This is done by the World Health Organization, the World Bank, and now a group that's supported by Google in Seattle. And what you can see is, again, in a way that maybe most of us hadn't appreciated before, brain disorders, that's mental and behavioral disorders and frank neurological disorders, are the largest single source of disability in the United States. These are U.S. data, although the study's done for is a global burden of disease. It wasn't always like this, so we are now sort of emerging as the single biggest public health challenge in a century in which chronic non-communicable diseases will be the big challenge, in the same way that infectious diseases were in the last century. And part of the reason that mental illness in particular is causing so much disability is because it starts so early. So these are numbers that we've taken from that global burden of disease study, and we've sort of calculated based on what they're collecting. What's the sort of life course? When does the burden of disease show up? And all of you will know this, but again, it bears repeating that mental illnesses are the chronic and disabling disorders of children and adolescents and young adults, 75% of the time beginning before age 25. So that's really very different than the picture we have of cancer, of stroke, of dementia, of heart disease. These are by far and away the public health problem up until age 50. And these data, with the red line representing the mental and behavioral disorders, and you can just see that difference between up until about age 50, even to age 60, between that group and cancer and cardiovascular diseases, which are those other lines, very, very different. Now, all of this leads to sort of this, a little bit of head scratching, because this is not a competition where you want to win. You don't want to be number one in either disability or in mortality. I'm not telling you this as part of a victory speech. And in fact, the state of what we're dealing with ain't great relative to these other disorders. And part of why I think it's so important to step back and look at the success stories and the picture across all of medicine is to realize that we've actually learned some great lessons from heart disease and cancer and other areas about how to succeed. But unfortunately, I don't think we've been able to incorporate those yet into the way we either study or treat or even diagnose mental illness. And that's much of what I want to talk about. Here we've got a very late diagnosis because our diagnostics are completely limited to symptoms, and across medicine, symptoms are a late manifestation. We don't know the cause, and you always have trouble in medicine when you are not sure about the cause and you're just treating the symptoms, because it's very hard to do prevention, for instance, if you don't know who's at risk and you don't know what you're trying to prevent. And finally, our treatments, as many of you unfortunately know too well, are mostly through trial and error. We just aren't at the point where we really understand which treatment for which person. We don't have treatments, as Ken said at the outset, that are really nearly as effective as what we'd like. We're one of the few areas of medicine where we don't have vaccines, or we're not working on vaccines. So we've got some challenges. Now, that leads to the first inconvenient truth, and I say this because I think we have to grapple with it, and I think we have to be honest about it. We really have not bent the curve here for morbidity or mortality. We've failed. And we need to be asking ourselves why this is. There are lots of explanations out there, and I'll just run through some of them with you, and many of them are so familiar, and we don't have to spend a lot of time on this. But the most common one is that the system's broken, right? We don't have access. We don't have good quality of care. And there are really good data for that. If you just take an estimate of the number of people who are affected, something like roughly 15 million people with serious mental illness in this country, however you want to define that, only about 40% of them, even a little less than that, ever receive any services at all. Of those, about a third get even minimally effective care, and only about a third will respond because our treatments aren't 100% effective. So you start doing that kind of math and you see very quickly why we haven't bent the curve, because not that many people would have gotten a treatment that would have been helpful, you know, in with these kinds of statistics. The other common explanation is this whole business about all the things that just make this area very different than cancer or heart disease. There's nobody accountable. A great example is if the homicide rates start to climb, you know who to fire. And that's certainly true for traffic fatalities, and it's actually true even for infectious diseases. But we do not know who's accountable for those suicide numbers. If they go up, who do you go to? And in fact, who's producing the numbers from last month? We have numbers from 2011. We now have numbers from 2012, but we are way behind. We have the Ebola numbers from last week. We have the AIDS numbers from last month, but we're woefully behind on just tracking deaths from mental illness. Denial of illness, huge issue for us. That is not such a great problem in most of the rest of medicine. And how we grapple with that becomes really, really essential, I think, if we're going to be able to bend the curve. This is one of those places that makes everybody uncomfortable, because it goes into issues around how we give care to people who don't think they're sick. And yet, until we get serious about this particular issue, we're not going to see numbers begin to change. Fragmentation, of course, you've heard a lot about that. That's a big topic everywhere. And the criminalization, there's no other area of medicine that would even tolerate that, let alone experience it. So those issues have all been talked about throughout this meeting, and I'm not going to spend much more time on them. I do want to say that there are some interesting, we can call them counterfactuals, that are worth thinking about. Sherry Gleed came to a meeting that we supported, and some of you were there, actually, a few months ago, and she reminded us that actually when you track the numbers over the last 30 years or so, there's actually been an increase, not a decrease. So even though in people getting treatment, we tend to say that there's that, you know, that terrible attrition, as I showed you already a couple of slides back, and that there's no access. But in fact, the data would suggest that more people with serious mental illness, that's those two bars on the right, are getting treated than ever before. Well, even though the numbers are not 100%, but they're certainly going up. And indeed, when you look at medications just as a proxy for anybody at least getting diagnosed and treated, the numbers are stunning. We've seen more than a doubling just in the last decade. That's not to say that this is good treatment or sufficient treatment, but it does run against the idea that nobody's getting care. In fact, it suggests that people are getting more care than ever. And in fact, when you go to administrative data, there are evidence there, too, for all kinds of increases, whether it's more people on SSI or more payments via Medicaid. The evidence actually suggests that, contrary to what I've been saying, which is that nobody's getting treated and there's no access, and that actually there's quite a bit and more all the time. So in a sense, this is even a more uncomfortable insight, because if that is true, and I think it's arguable, but if it's true to some extent, it says that even though more people are getting more of today's treatments, our outcomes aren't getting any better. And I have to tell you that that's very different than the picture with HIV. If you increase treatment for HIV by 100%, which is what we've done in the case of medications for mental illness, you're going to see the prevalence and the outcomes much, much different. You're going to really see that impact. We're not seeing that here, even though there is a 100% increase in the use of antidepressants and virtually 100% increase in the use of antipsychotics. So my point is that if we're going to bend the curve, it's not just about giving access. It's not just about quantity, but it has to be about options, and it has to be about quality. And we haven't thought carefully enough about those issues. So this is very different than what you're going to hear from most people, because everybody is so concerned about making sure you get treatment. And what I'm trying to tell you is I wish that was good enough. You know, I wish just getting people into treatment, which is hard enough, would ensure that they would get well. But it just isn't the case. We really have to do much better. And if we're going to improve options and we're going to improve quality, my point today is that we really need to think about a different approach. Now, thinking about a different approach comes in a couple of different flavors. One was suggested just recently by Kay Jamison in this amazing op-ed piece, very brief but brilliant, that she wrote in the wake of Robin Williams' suicide. There was an awful lot written that week about suicide. But for me, there was nothing more compelling than Kay's comments about her own suicide and her statement in the New York Times, that, as she says here, that depression can be treated, but it takes competence. And her argument there and now elsewhere has been, it isn't just about access. It has to be about improving quality. You have to have people who know what evidence-based care is and who raise the bar and improve the quality of care because they can deliver something that really does work. And that we just don't have enough people who can do that. And there's so one whole piece of a different approach is to say, take what we already know and make sure that it's being done in a way that works. That's the competence question or the competence issue. And I'm not going to say much more about that. I'll come back to that at the end. What I want to just quickly talk to you about is a different approach, which is based on two revolutions taking place. One's the genomic revolution. And by the way, this is the entrance to the Smithsonian exhibit. If you haven't had even an hour, it's so close to get away and see this. When the meeting is over, so don't do it now, but sometime later today, if your flight's tomorrow, zip over to the Museum of Natural History where we have this fantastic exhibit on the genome, and it takes about half an hour to go through. It is really amazing. But it basically tells you about the revolution in genomics over the last 10 years and why this is so important, and we'll say a bit more about that in a moment. The other is the neuroscience revolution, which the president has now called the Brain Initiative, and he's identified that as the key initiative for his second term in science, anyway. He said that he wanted to have one major scientific project, like a moonshot, in his second 4 years, and there was a lot of debate. At one point, it was going to be shooting asteroids out of the atmosphere, but fortunately, his staff and he decided ultimately that it would be much better to do something about brain disorders. And so he's called for what he calls the next great American project, which is to explore inner space instead of outer space and to try to understand the brain. And that has really kicked off this second revolution, which we're right at the very beginning of. So let me quickly take you through some recent insights from both of these and just let you know where we're at for both of them, because I think they do suggest a different approach, but not one that's going to be immediate. Genomics. We've had a huge amount happening, and you may have heard from Danny Weinberger about this yesterday, for those of you who could attend his talk. But a lot of this is driven by changes in technology. The cost of sequencing DNA has dropped by a millionfold since 2001 or 2002, and most of that's just in the last 5 years. This graph shows you how that's changed. A million bases of DNA. It used to cost about $10,000 to sequence, and now we do it for a few pennies. And the result of that is that we've had, just over that time, over the last 5 years, really, this fantastic growth in the discovery of genetic variation that's associated with mental illness. Notice how complicated that last sentence was. It's not that we found genes for mental illness, though we'd like to think that we have. It's really finding variation, which all of us have, and some of those variations are associated with height, and some are associated with obesity, and some are associated with intelligence, and some are associated with vulnerability, we think, or resistance to a range of diseases, including mental illness. What makes the mental disorders genes The ones that are associated, or the variances that are associated. Complicated is that there are so many of them. We didn't know that, but we do now. And it's the result of bringing a lot of people together. I think at this point we're at 80 institutions in 30 countries working together to map all of this. And they've all now collaborated in a great way with tens of thousands, actually hundreds of thousands of samples that we've been able to use. It took a while to do that. When we started in 2011, we only had 9,000 cases, and you can see from this, these are called Manhattan plots, and Danny probably showed these yesterday, but wherever you see a spike that goes above that horizontal line, that's a statistically significant association. That means it's a variation in the genome that shows up more commonly in people who have an illness. In this case, we're looking at schizophrenia. When we got to 14,000 cases in 2012, it got a little more interesting. There were 22, not just 5. When we got to 2013, with over 30,000 cases, it went up to about 70. And now, just a couple of months ago, we've had this paper that's gotten so much attention with well over 100 hits at this point. And that's continuing to go up. And so we've gone from a point where 5 years ago we actually didn't have enough to study to now being overwhelmed by the number of candidates. I sometimes like to say this is a little bit like a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, and it probably will be about 1,000 hits ultimately that could be discovered. And we're just still putting together the edge pieces to see how they fit. And what we can say from that, and this cartoon kind of gives you a sense of that, is that there are a lot. This is genetically very complex, that many of these are not the genes that we were expecting. So these aren't the serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, the sort of things that every textbook talks about. These are genes we never heard of before. And many of them are involved in building the brain, and some are involved in the synapse, in that really critical area between neurons where information flows back and forth. But to be honest, a lot of them, we have no idea why they're involved or if they're involved. All we know is that there's a statistical association here, and we're using this as a way to get into the biology of the illness, or at least the biology of risk for the illness, because this is really about risk. This has paid off pretty well for Crohn's disease, inflammatory bowel disease. I think it's doing well in diabetes. It's been spectacular in some areas like cystic fibrosis. So genomics has really kind of opened up lots of great insights into the biology of disease in many areas of medicine. We're still early on here. And I have suspicions about how far this will take us. I think we have to remember that the heritability of all of our illnesses is still fairly limited. So even identical twins don't have 100% concordance. At most, they have 50%, and sometimes much, much less. As I said a couple of years ago in Seattle when we were talking about this, important to remember that genetics is not the same as heritability. You can have a genetic lesion or genetic variation, which you didn't get from mom and dad. Some of these things happen in the course of development. We call those not inherited mutations, but somatic mutations. It's just a technical term. But that's important to know because people are always beating themselves up if they have children with an illness, and children with an illness may be blaming their parents. And it's important to know, we know this, for instance, that in the case of cancer, even though there are heritable signs and heritable genetic changes that make you maybe more at risk or more resilient, that the actual mutation that causes the cancer is in that tumor. It's nowhere else in your body. We don't know, but that could be happening for schizophrenia and for autism and bipolar illness. That's an open question because we haven't really looked carefully enough at brain tissue to know about that. But it just, the kinds of insights we're getting here are really important for those reasons. It tells you on the one hand that the risk architecture, which we're thinking about, is a whole different kind of science and a whole different biology than what we've been thinking about in the past. So it's opening all this up, and it's far more complicated than any of us would have liked. But it's also telling us that the complications are also in the way that these disorders, all disorders, are transmitted, that the simple kind of Mendelian models that we have from Huntington's disease and sickle cell and cystic fibrosis. It isn't like that here. These are much more complicated and need to be, we need to give ourselves a break here in thinking about the link between genetics and heritability, because it's not a one-to-one relationship. Real quickly on this neuroscience revolution, this brain initiative, this is actually quite amazing. We are, for the first time, getting the tools that we've needed to understand how the brain works. It is it's kind of another inconvenient truth. I haven't put that on a slide, but we know much, much less about the brain than we know about the heart, the kidney, the lungs, the pancreas. And so part of what we're trying to do here is simply to get the parts list. How many different kinds of cells are there in the brain? Are there special cells in the human brain that you don't find in the chimp or the mouse brain? Are there pathways that are new that we need to understand that may be related to mental illness? And so what we've needed are the tools to begin to explore all of that. And we have a new project called the Human Connectome Project, which is just fantastic. It's like the Human Genome Project, except it's trying to give us both the tools and the reference atlas that we'll need to map the human brain and to understand that whole range of variation that all of us might have and who's on kind of one extreme of that variation. We've done that for genomics, and now we have this whole process of tying individual variation to risk and resilience. We still need to do this for brain architecture, and you can see that with structural and functional studies, we're beginning to make that happen. The story is really spectacular because just very recently we've gotten the tools to be able to map the wiring diagram, which you see here in these spectacular colors from Mass General Hospital, that shows us how the brain is wired at a level of detail we haven't had before. And we're beginning to get the same kinds of studies for the function as well as the structure that helps us to understand what are the pathways of relevance. It's still a bit early, but already with those early insights, we can begin to identify the circuits associated with mental illness. We have some for OCD, certainly some for PTSD that are very different from OCD or other anxiety disorders, and some for depression. So we're just getting now this kind of picture of how these different circuits play out. Now, this leads to yet a third inconvenient truth, which is that while we have all this fantastically cool new science, it still has not given us the tools we need to prevent mental illness. I love the concept of recovery, but it's completely aspirational. We're still at a point where we can't tell people that everybody can recover. We don't say that for cancer, and we shouldn't be saying that for mental illness. These are really bad diseases, and we need to understand that. So what I'm arguing for is that if we're going to bend the curve here, we've got to take the revolutions that are happening in genomics and in neuroscience and now really apply them to change the way we do diagnosis and to change the way we do treatment and treatment development. And I want to take a couple of minutes to unpack both of those because I think they're important. For diagnostics, the change is actually almost a conceptual change. We want to go from thinking about these as behavioral disorders. I think we really sell ourselves short. It's important. Language really counts. It's important. The words we use really do matter. And by saying these are behavioral disorders, we ignore an enormous amount. To say these are brain disorders comes with its own set of issues, but I just can't imagine where cardiology would be if we called all of the different forms of heart disease chest pain disorders. We don't want to be there. We have to get beyond that. It's the same. The same issue is true for treatment. And here I think the problem of sort of thinking about these, the brain as a kind of bag of chemicals and what you have is a chemical imbalance, that's worked well in some ways as a communication device, but it just can't be accurate. What we're talking about increasingly is that these are disorders of circuit function. And again, if we want to use the heart analogy, it would be like you can have heart attack, a myocardial infarction where you've actually blown out a piece of your heart. That would be maybe the analogy with Parkinson's disease or with certain forms of dementia where you have a huge amount of dead tissue. I don't think that's what we're talking about with schizophrenia or bipolar illness or depression or borderline. I mean, these are all really disorders of brain circuits. So what you, in a sense, that would be the maybe the right analogy would be these are like cardiac arrhythmias. These are conduction problems in the heart, except that they're in the brain. And so our treatments, as in the same way that we treat cardiac arrhythmias, needs to be more focused on how do we tune circuits, how do we get the rhythms and the connections working in the way that they should. Those are very different approaches to diagnosis and to therapeutics, and it's worth just taking a moment to think about what that means. So today, for diagnosis, we'll take that one first. As I said at the outset, we're diagnosing only by symptoms, which is a real problem. The diagnostic categories we have were essentially defined by a group of clinicians who get together and vote by consensus. That is done, actually, in some other areas of medicine, but it's never really where you want to be. We have very mostly reliable diagnoses. Depression and anxiety is not so much, but certainly the psychotic illnesses, we have pretty good agreement and reliability. But the validity, the biological validity of any of these categories is up for grabs. They're very heterogeneous. We don't know how many kinds of depression there are, but there are over 250 different ways you can get the diagnosis. And some involve, you know, sleeping too much, some involve insomnia, some involve eating too much, some involve loss of appetite, just a whole range of different symptom clusters. And it's amazing that we've decided to use one word, and not a very good one, by the way, to describe all of that. Symptoms are late. I mentioned that before. In the case of Parkinson's, we know that by the time you develop rigidity and slowness, you've lost 80% of your dopamine in the brain. For dementia, it's 25 years of brain loss before you start to show memory problems. So when for brain disorders in general, symptoms are a very late manifestation. And if you've got your diagnosis only based on symptoms, you constrained yourself already by saying we're going to get there late in the game. And all of you know that whether it's cancer or heart disease, when you get there at the late stage, the outcomes aren't that great. And finally, this is really the most insidious problem, I think. It's as if because we've defined everything by symptoms, our treatments then become geared accordingly. And again, to use that heart disease analogy, it would be like saying that what we really want to do is give people the medicines for chest pain rather than figuring out what's going on in the heart that needs to be treated, whether that's surgical or medical or behavioral. So it's a really key issue that we don't think enough about, but we should, that when you've got a diagnostic system that is only limited to symptoms, you're going to be doing therapeutics that are about symptom relief and not about cure. Imagine if the only treatments we had for infectious disease were aspirin for the fever. That's the problem we've got here. So we've drilled into this a little bit. We've begun to look at how heterogeneous and what that kind of biological validity might be. And it's just one example for lack of time, but in PTSD is a good one. If you take all anxiety disorders and you start just to look at startle, which is just a fundamental physiological property, you can see that people with PTSD are at two ends of the spectrum here. That's not what you want for a precise diagnosis. And this idea of, you know, getting precision medicine, getting diagnoses that are really precise, is really what has bent the curve in cancer recently. It's being able to say that breast cancer is six or eight different diseases requiring six or eight different treatments. It wasn't until we got to that point that we started to save lives. And we're not at that point yet for PTSD or for any of the disorders we care about. So we've created this new system called the Research Domain Criteria System. It's RDoC. It's gotten, unfortunately, a lot of controversy around it. It really shouldn't, because it's no different than what we're doing in all these other areas of medicine. RDoC is based on the idea that symptoms are important, but you need to have lots of other kinds of information from biology, social factors, environmental issues, everything that you can put together to try to understand the domain of functioning. And what we're hoping this will do is to get us to a point where we've got all of those contributing to whatever an individual's diagnosis ultimately is, that it doesn't happen by creating this Bible, like ICD or DSM, but it happens through a very iterative process that all of you will be part of. It's an information commons, and this is a really different way of doing this, but it says that in the age of big data, we should be collecting all this information and let the information, let the data tell us where the classifiers ought to be. We've just done this for psychosis, and it's just quite extraordinary that when you bring together a couple thousand people with all kinds of different psychotic illnesses, schizophrenia, bipolar, schizoaffective, whatever their label happens to be, and then you collect lots of biological information, and then you ask the computer to tell you where the classifiers are, you come up with completely different clusters, which actually look valid, actually look far more useful than the clusters based only on symptoms. That's where we're going because we think it will be more valid and more reliable, and it will be more specific. It will help us to understand much more about risk. And ultimately, the idea here is to get interventions that are much more specific. And that leads me to say a bit about treatments, because that's actually just as dismal in some ways as the diagnostic problem. And this is an area I really don't need to spend much time on with you because you unfortunately know all too well that the treatment system isn't working. It's fragmented. People either get medications, means a 10-minute visit, maybe once a month, maybe once every 3 months. You've got only this focus on how do you control the symptoms, not how do you cure the illness. And we have every bit of evidence that people, for the most part, people don't like the treatments. They don't adhere to them because they're, even if they are helpful in some ways, they're harmful in others. There's very little innovation here, and we've had, especially for medications, most of the companies have dropped out or are moving out of this area. They're going someplace where they feel there's less risk and more success. Lots of reasons for that, which we can talk about if you like. That's never a good thing, whether you distrust and dislike the pharmaceutical industry or not. They have traditionally invested a huge amount of money into understanding these disorders and providing some useful medications. They don't do that anymore, and that's a real loss for us. The most innovation has been in psychosocial treatments, in psychotherapies and in devices, which is really fantastic. So over the last decade, that's where all the hot, cool stuff is happening. But unfortunately there, we often don't have the kind of information that the FDA would require of medications. We don't know what's the right dose for psychotherapy. We don't know what the duration is. And the result is that a lot of places are saying, why would I pay for this if I don't know what the efficacy rules are, what the standard should be? So we're at a point where there's real problems with reimbursement on that side. People don't do it. There's a relatively small, limited fidelity often to what has been shown to be useful. And we have this funky situation in which if you've got a kid with an illness, the treatment they get is going to depend much more on who you happen to call or who you get sent to rather than what they actually require. And again, we would never, ever tolerate that for heart disease or cancer, and yet it's become the standard of care for our illnesses, which we've got to figure out a way to fix. So I don't want you to think of this as complete doom and gloom, because there are some very exciting things recently. The emergence of ketamine has completely changed the way we think about antidepressants. Ketamine is given intravenously. It's an anesthetic. It's not yet approved for use for depression. It's being used off-label. It's still very much a research tool. It's not ready for broad clinical use. But the research itself deserves some attention here because this has changed the way we think about antidepressants. Most of the SSRIs or the tricyclic antidepressants take 6 to 8 weeks to work. Ketamine works in 6 hours. And that's a real game changer. That means that when we start thinking about new antidepressants, we can shift away from the 6-8 week rule and begin thinking about, as we should have years ago, it's amazing actually, that we ever tolerated treatments for such a serious fatal illness that would take 8 weeks. It's kind of phenomenal to think that was our standard. Well, it shouldn't be anymore. You know, we now know as a proof of principle that you can do this quickly. And so this has been a real game changer. It's very exciting. Family-focused therapy for anorexia has, again, been fascinating. The classic treatments for anorexia in adolescence was what we used to call a parentectomy. The parents are the problem. Get the kid away. And today, we've done just the flip side of that. So Locke and colleagues at Stanford have shown that if you train the parents, involve the parents in the treatment, actually get them to be the center of this, that you reduce, you get about a 50% remission rate at 6 months, and it's held for 2 years. Far, far better than traditional treatments. So this actually saves lives. This is obviously an illness with a 10% mortality rate. So that's an extraordinary win, and it's one that we don't hear enough about. And then there are various ways of tuning circuits that have gotten us interested. That's just a proof of principle, whether it's deep brain stimulation or TMS or a bunch of other things we can talk about. So I think going forward, what we're looking for are treatments that are quite different. They'll be person-centered. They'll be networked. It won't be a simple magic bullet the way we've been thinking about. They'll be based on brain circuits. They'll probably have a whole toolkit that you can put together, and they'll be integrated with medical care. So that'll be exciting. Here's the problem, for me anyway, and I think really for you. Said everything that I've been talking about is going to take some time. The genomics revolution is still playing out for cancer and hypertension, and it's going to play out even longer for schizophrenia and bipolar illness. And the neuroscience revolution is still very much underway, and it's going to be a decade, I think, before we have the real tools we need to see to study the brain at the speed of thought, which is what we're trying to do if we want to understand these various circuits. And I don't know that any of us want to wait 10 years for something that is useful and helpful to come from science. And so what I'd like to do in the few minutes that are left is to talk to you about some near-term gains and some things that have happened recently. And they really are based fundamentally on the best science, in a sense that science has actually changed the way we can approach a really serious problem. So let me tell you this story, because I think that's the best way is to give you the narrative and give you a sense of how this could work across the board. We don't know what the fundamental biology of schizophrenia is. We actually think schizophrenia may be many illnesses, and some of them probably involve changes in the wiring, in the white matter, which we call myelin, that's just deficient in this illness. Some are probably due to an excessive pruning of synapses, especially excitatory synapses, and especially those in the prefrontal cortex. And there's been a little bit of discussion about this already at the meeting. And some probably involve this overgrowth of loss of inhibitory cells. And there's a lot of evidence for that. In fact, there's evidence for all three of these ideas about what schizophrenia is. And they're probably all right, because probably some people with schizophrenia have more or less of any of these mechanisms, and I'm sure there'll be other mechanisms that will emerge as well. You can think of schizophrenia maybe the way we today think about epilepsy or hypertension. It's many, many illnesses, and we'll be dissecting them out kind of one at a time, and there'll still be probably a group we don't understand, but in a few years we'll have a much better handle on this. Nevertheless, I think what's important from this picture is to realize that whatever schizophrenia is, it is neurodevelopmental. It is like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and Huntington's and all these other disorders of the brain, something that happens over a long time. And as with those other disorders, there's every reason to think that when symptoms develop around age 18 to 20, or when psychosis emerges, you're already pretty late in that process. So we have defined schizophrenia by the presence of psychosis, but that's really, as you see in this picture, probably stage 3. That's probably fairly late. And actually what makes this really important to understand is that almost all of our attention on both the research side and on the treatment side has been out here, It's been in the kind of rehabilitative phase. It's as if in the world of cardiology, we only were talking about what do we do for people at end-stage heart disease, and that's very important. But that doesn't bend the curve. That doesn't really get us to where we want to be. Incredibly important to have better interventions for people at that stage and to improve their lifestyle and to improve their options. But to do only that would be incredibly short-sighted and narrow-minded. That's not the world we want to live in. So how do we get further upstream? And we've been very focused at the NIMH on this two areas, actually three areas. The first is this stage three, as we like to call it, or the first episode psychosis, FEP, first episode psychosis, is an area that we've put a lot of time and energy into in the last few years. And some of you got to hear John Kane yesterday, who talked here about the RAISE project. For those of you who couldn't hear John, just a real quick rundown. This was actually two studies, not one, that were rolled out in 36 sites across the country with almost 500 people involved. And the idea here was to take those interventions that we've known about for a while. So this isn't like developing a new treatment that could be really a whiz-bang, cool new thing. It was taking the things that we knew about, like supported employment and family psychoeducation, and things that NAMI's actually been promoting for years, but things that don't get paid for unless you're at the very late stage. You can get supported employment and some of these things paid for when you have a chronic illness, but we weren't getting them in many states at first episode. And so the question was how to pull all of these together into a toolkit, essentially, that would be something you could deploy in a community setting, something that families and consumers could engage with easily, and something that would get paid for and get picked up for, because in fact we could show that it would save money instead of just cost money. It does cost more up front, but in the long run, we think there'll be enormous savings. And as John probably explained yesterday, the essence of this is sort of client-centered care, so it's very much focused on individual choice. There's a whole series of options in this, and you can see that some of them do involve sort of low-dose medication, but there's a bunch of other things around care management and link into primary care and a range of others. The key here is that you don't do this alone. You've got everything on the one hand being focused on the individual and giving them the options, and on the other hand, they've got somebody to hold a hand through this. And this is really important. It's sort of a navigator, whether it's a case manager or a family member or somebody who is helps to navigate this very, very complicated set of options. And amazing, if when you step back and look at this, is to think that anybody can navigate this, but especially when you're going through the middle of a psychotic episode and you can't sleep and you're on medication and you can't think very well, to try to do it then is almost absolutely out of the question. So putting all this together, making it simple, providing the navigator or the person who can walk with you to make sure this gets done well, and then providing this ongoing care, which is really critical, because all of you know that story that somebody gets ill for the first time, they get on medicines, at best the medicines are effective enough to reduce their symptoms, they decide 3 weeks later that they're fine because actually the symptoms are no longer as great of a problem, and they stop the medicine, they get sick in 2 weeks, they're back in the emergency room, and it's just this revolving door. All of this is meant to prevent that. Much more information about this. And all of the tools that go into the toolbox are on our website. So you're interested in this and you didn't get to hear John yesterday, you can go to our website and go to this page about RAISE, which has lots of the information. The piece that I think is really important for you to know about is that this has very quickly gone from a concept and a kind of research project now to being implemented. So the feasibility study, which took about 4 years, was completed in December by Lisa Dixon and Jeff Lieberman, working out of Columbia and Hopkins here in Maryland. Congress required SAMHSA to implement this, or something like it. We call it coordinated specialty care, but it's basically a RAISE-like intervention. in the mental health block grant program in this year, in 2014. So they required this in January. And by the end of this month, actually it's already happened, every state, so all 50 states and 8 territories have to have a plan in place for how they will implement this kind of a program. We always say, yeah. It's kind of amazing. I mean, we're always dumping on Congress because they're dysfunctional. And then we've got this idea that it takes 17 years to get from a discovery to implementation. That's actually is true for hypertension. This case, we actually counted it up. It was 17 weeks. So I thought that was a pretty good calculus. And it's one of the things we're most excited about. And again, if you didn't get to hear John and his presentation yesterday, go to the website. There's lots more about this to let you know about it. So that's this second phase, which we think actually is not going to take forever. And we think this is going to have an enormous impact, at least in those states where they have already have a bit of the infrastructure and they can use the mental health block grant money to get things going. So we think this is going to be incredibly important. What we're looking now is how to expand it, how to keep it going, and how to make this standard of care across the country. But we're on a very, very fast uptake cycle here. So that's that first episode part, which we think is really spectacular. What about the next phase? Because ultimately, we want to do what's been done for heart disease. And remember, when I showed you those 1.1 million deaths averted in that first slide for heart disease, a lot of that's from prevention. A lot of that is not that you've got people who've had a heart attack and you've found a better treatment. What you've done is you've prevented people from getting heart attacks, and you've done that through changes in lifestyle, through statins, through just much better diagnoses of risk, that is, predictions of risk. So this CHR means clinically high risk phase, sometimes called the prodrome, is a really interesting problem. And what we've really been thinking about most of all in our shop is this question. There are about 100,000 adolescents and young adults who will have their first psychotic episode this year. And what would it take to turn that number from 100,000 to 50,000? All of you understand that the economics of that, that is the benefit, just pure business benefit of doing that, is astronomical, because you're talking about lifelong costs from disability for an illness in which 85% of people remain unemployed. So if you could prevent onset, even in 5% or 10%, you'd have a fantastic way of impacting public health. You really would bend the curve there more than anything else we can do. But there are two things you have to have to be able to prevent this, just as we've learned from heart disease. One is you have to know who's really at risk, because there are not going to be universal interventions that are going to fix this. It's not like putting fluoride into the water. We're going to have to come up with something that says this is one of those 100,000 15-year-olds. And how do we do that? And the amazing thing is we've got a really exciting new opportunity here. There's a project we've called the NAPLES Project. Government acronyms are impossible, but this one is North American Prodrome Longitudinal Study. So we took a few hundred, in this case almost 1,000, young people who were thought to be at risk because their parents had brought them in, or they had come in because of problems in school, problems in thinking, problems in sleeping, anything that gave us the sense that this was somebody who might be on that trajectory. And there are probably about 500,000 of those across the country today that people are concerned about at age 15, 16, 17, because something's happening. Their grades have dropped, their spending all their time, they've lost their friends, they're spending all their time playing video games in the basement. Some people call it these basement kids. And we're not sure what's going to happen to them. It turns out that most of them do fine, that out of that 500,000, only about 100,000, about one in five, will convert. And what this thing is that we call the prodrome is sort of that syndrome, that basement kid syndrome on steroids. In this study, there were 11% identified with the prodrome who would transition to having frank psychosis, meeting the criteria for a psychotic illness within 1 year. But here's the really amazing thing from this science, from this research, is that we're now able to identify those predictors that will get us to something like 70 to 80% confidence that this is somebody who's really at very high risk. That's about where we are now for heart disease and for many forms of cancer. So this puts us in the game. This says, okay, now we can actually do clinical trials. We can do prevention trials. We can make this tractable because we're not talking about studies in which even the control group will have only a 5% or 10% conversion rate, because then it's impossible to know whether your intervention has worked or not. So what is the intervention? What can we do based on that? Well, we don't know yet. The recent review of this that was done, published in the British Medical Journal, pulled together everything that we've done up until this point, and it's been quite a bit. And just to sort of summarize this, and it's a little unfair because there are a lot of nuances, but the quick answer is that some things do seem to help. Cognitive behavior therapy that's focused on this set of issues, CBT, does seem to be very helpful. The evidence is still moderate, meaning that the studies aren't ideal, but the four or five studies we have so far each show something like a 50% reduction in conversion. That's amazing. That is simply amazing. If we had a 5% reduction in the conversion of dementia in people at risk for Alzheimer's, we would be running victory laps. We've got something here that could be as much as a 50% reduction. We need to really chase that and understand it better and figure out which kids that's really helping the most and what, how to optimize that and how to generalize it. Antipsychotics, which are probably the thing that are used most often in practice, there's no evidence at this point that those are helpful in somebody that doesn't have a psychotic illness. And there's some evidence that they're probably harmful. So that's not the direction to go in kids with the prodrome or kids at high risk. There is one study with omega-3s that actually looks pretty good. And we're trying to replicate that now in a very large multi-site study. I'm very skeptical, but I got to believe what's in the data. And for a first study, it's a single site, you know, big study, the results were really promising. We'll know more about that within about very few months because this has been put on the fast track and we're really eager to see the results of a much, much larger effort. So I would say maybe. I think we need to know. Targeted cognitive training is getting a lot of attention, especially in Silicon Valley and on the West Coast. That's the idea. You could develop video games that would help to sort of tune the brain circuits involved here. Kids are playing video games 40 hours a week anyway. Why not give them something that will improve their executive function and get their grades back? We don't know. The idea isn't such a completely weird one. I mean, we do this all the time for sort of for physical training. Could we do this for brain training as well? And so there's been a lot of effort on ADHD and in areas of anxiety and now even in autism with social processing and helping kids to process face information. Could we do this for somebody at clinically high risk for a psychotic illness? We don't know that. I think the data are still early stage, but we're excited about this as a possibility because we do think it has that opportunity to generalize quickly. You could implement quickly, and if it works, that would be fantastic. So this other phase, this early high-risk phase, the prodrome, the Naples findings, I think, are really giving us something that we can begin to use in the short term, begin to guide how we intervene and what we do. The final piece of this is now thinking about earlier, even earlier than that, and that is this the period in which somebody has no symptoms and has simply got the risk diathesis, that risk genomics or the risk for whatever reason because of the way their brain is configured. And there we're not. We really don't have anything at this point that is ready for prime time. The genetics, as I said before, very interesting. There'll be lots of opportunities, but incredibly complicated. And that is not at a point where the risk profiling is great. The one thing we do have there, which I should mention, is that in that most recent study, the one that just came out, they've divided, they looked at everybody in a huge population, several hundred thousand people, and they knew who did have a psychotic illness. And they created this thing called the polygenic risk score. So you put in all the millions of data points and you say, based on this, who would be at the 10% highest risk, who would be at the 10% lowest risk? And what is amazing is that those people who have the genetic profile, that fingerprint with the 10% highest risk, are at about a 15 to 20-fold higher risk for the illness than the general population. And that is promising. It says that there may be a fingerprint there that we could begin to make actionable, although we're not there yet. So, to finish up, what have we learned? Early intervention is critical. We know that from heart disease. We know that from cancer. We've got to learn that for mental illness. The interventions, it's not going to be fixing a chemical imbalance, although maybe that's part of it. It's going to be tuning circuits and figuring out where the circuit arrhythmia is, where the abnormality is, and finding a way to manage that. And we have to increasingly get away from this idea that there'll be a magic bullet, that there's going to be a pill, or there's going to be a device, or there's going to be one thing that will make the difference. I think the RAISE experience is great. The RAISE experience tells us that what we're really, we've got to think about this the way we think about diabetes. And what we've learned in diabetes is that it's putting it all together. It's creating a whole network solution that involves many different kinds of interventions and bundling them together in a way that people will pay for, and they'll pay for it because it saves money as well as giving you better outcomes. That's really the trick. That's what RAISE does. And that's what we want to now think about in many other venues. What would that look like for PTSD? What would it look like for depression? How do we do this in a way in this new healthcare environment that makes it feasible and actually makes it fundable in a way that our treatments haven't been so much in the past? So this leads me to the final inconvenient truth, which is not one that I am happy to share with you, but I think we, again, have to accept this, that science is slow. It's a marathon. And that isn't any different in cancer. I mean, all of you see this. I mean, it's in the news every day. We've got now 2,000 deaths from Ebola. We know how to develop antivirals. We know how to develop vaccines. It's going to be a couple of years before we have what we need for Ebola. It takes time. And that's in a place where we know what we're going after. We have everything we need, and it's just an engineering problem to put it together. So imagine how much longer it's going to take to get the vaccine for schizophrenia or for borderline personality. There's a lot of challenge here. That's having been said, there's things we can do now, and those are the things we can focus on, and they come from the science. The long-term piece is we'll have better diagnostics, as I said, the new generation of network treatments, and bringing practice and research together. This whole idea that Kay Jamison talks about, making sure we build the competence into the workforce. But short term, some of that can happen. At the same time, we can bundle treatments together. We can disseminate those that work, like RAISE, as we've just seen. That's an amazing success story. We need to capitalize on that in lots of other areas and see that really go viral, to use an Ebola metaphor, so that we get some of this done in a way that doesn't take 17 or 20 years. That's really a matter of taking what we know and making sure that it is, in fact, what we do. And that has not happened enough. So to summarize, we've got these four inconvenient truths. We failed to bend the curve. We've got to think about options and quality, not just quantity. The sad thing about just not knowing enough, and I think we have to be honest about that, and that this is got to have both a long-term solution and a short-term game. And we've got to think about what we can do in the short term that really does make sure that we can maybe not bend the curve to zero, but at least not continue to see the numbers go up or even stay flat, but begin to see some effects. My bottom line here is that the path to better service has got to be better science. We've all got to be invested in knowing more, getting better science, altering diagnostics, altering treatments. That's the way to get better outcomes. Thanks very much.
Nice.
get those every day at Congress, I'm sure.
Well, that was about as elegant a summary talk as I've ever witnessed. So, there are many things to love about Tom Insel. One of them is he wants to spend 20 minutes listening to us and our questions. I'm going to ask you, because there's more than 1,500 people here, to ask your one favorite question. Take it away.
Thanks, Ken. Please identify yourself, too, because I'm still learning some of the 1,500 people here. I'm not great on names, but I'll do my best.
My name is Teresa Ritzema. I'm with NAMI Lansing, and I've been involved in NAMI about 12 years. I've devoted 30 years of my life to working with developmentally delayed children, starting with infants 0 to 3. That's been the primary focus. I have a lot of questions, but I'll narrow it down to one.
10 months to be one, yes.
Yesterday, Dr. Andrew Nirenberg.
Yes.
Talked about Precornet, a national parent,
patient-powered network. Right.
And he encouraged all of the people in the bipolar workshop to register and get on that.
Yep.
And you mentioned lots of things about research. Is that something you would promote?
Gosh, I wish I had talked about that. that's something I meant to talk about and didn't. So thank you for your question. So PCORI has been set up. It was actually set up in the Affordable Care Act, and it is this putting some funds aside, which don't come from the government. They're actually coming from other sources. It's about $1 billion at this point to support research for practical issues and for what sometimes is called comparative effectiveness. What works, what doesn't work, what should be done, often in a very large, rapid way. So we only have, of the, I think, 9 or 10 studies, there's only one in the area of mental illness. It's Andy Nirenberg's study, which is on depression broadly, but he wants to focus it to the extent that he can on bipolar. It requires 50,000 individuals with electronic medical records who would be willing to have those records shared and be followed longitudinally. And I think this is a fantastic opportunity, absolutely. We know that this has been useful in other medical areas. We haven't done it in this area, and I think Andy's project will help us to do it. So I wish I had been here to hear his talk. But I missed it. But I do know what he's involved with, and it's a great opportunity to follow. So thanks for bringing it up. NAMI, that's right. NAMI's a partner. I think he's reached out to DBSA and a few others as well, including NIMH. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Penny Fries. I'm the other half of Dr. Fred Fries. I have been working for the last 20 years on public education and mental health. If we know that these are childhood onset disorders, if we know the warning signs that indicate that something might be happening, where is the thrust in public education to notify the general public about this?
Yeah. So you're the second person to raise that with me this morning. Charlie had also raised it. I'm not sure I can see him here, but yeah, over here. So I think it's a really, Charlie's idea was actually that why aren't we building this into elementary, junior high, high school education? We have physical education. Why isn't, I'm going to take that as a comment as well as a question. And it's a question I'm going to ask as well, and maybe it's time to think about how we make this doable. I should tell you that there are some efforts like this. There's a very interesting effort being developed and already deployed in 8 states by Goldie Hawn, of all people. So there's something called the Hawn Foundation. Goldie, you know her as an actress, but she stopped acting something like 15 years ago and is devoted full time to this foundation, which is based in Florida, which on one part of it is kind of teaching mindfulness to children, but the other part is talking to them about brain disorders and mental illness and brain development. And that's one of several kinds of efforts like that. I mention HRSA because I think it's got a little more oomph to it than some. It says that it's feasible. We now need to think about how to do it more broadly and how to do it well. So thank you for the comment. Yeah.
Good morning. My name is Alicia, and I'm from NAMI, Colorado. And so the question that I have is whether or not the NIMH is focusing on research relating to epigenetic changes resulting from trauma or even intergenerational trauma.
We do fund research on, so we fund research on those things that aren't just related to gene sequence, but epigenetics, which is the way in which the environment affects how the genome gets read out. You can think of it as kind of like these are editors. You know, they go through these epigenetic marks. They will either highlight an area that says express more of this, or they'll redact an area so it silences a part of the genome. And those are really important, that those kinds of changes, which are not inherited, at least most of them aren't, are happening throughout your life. And they're the reason why a kidney cell and a liver cell are different, but they're also the reason why experience gets, like learning, actually has more than just a transient effect because it changes gene expression over time. So we study that, absolutely. The question, though, about trauma is one that raises other issues, because I think there's been a tendency by many to think that it's because of trauma that the genome gets changed, and that's the source of all brain disorders or mental illness. Most of the epigenetics we know about has to do with toxins of various sorts. So, you know, what do heavy metals do? What do various other serious chemical influences on the genome, how do they work? The extent to which, I think it's a research question, the extent to which trauma affects the genomic output, the way it's read. But the extent to which trauma is the basis for serious mental illnesses like psychosis or like schizophrenia or bipolar, I just don't know the evidence for that. I think there's a tendency for many in the field to sort of point to that. But, you know, it's really an assumption that the science doesn't support it at this point. There is no question that early adversity is related to certain outcomes, including some that have to do with mood and anxiety disorders. And it's absolutely the case that an illness like PTSD can be tracked to, by definition, a traumatic event. But one shouldn't assume that anorexia or schizophrenia or bipolar, a lot of these others have that same connection. I think that tends to happen a lot in this field. And just to be clear, the science doesn't really yet prove that. And I don't think it's falsified it either, but it's just very much an assumption. Yes?
I'm Jim Hayes from South Carolina. Two-part question. Postmortem brain tissue donation, the importance of that, and also the development of a three-dimensional functional brain tissue model?
Yeah, both really interesting questions. So the postmortem for this field is vital because it does involve the brain. We don't have enough information about how the brain works. It's actually one of the original founders of NAMI, Fuller Torrey, actually set up the first great brain bank. And you know him because he's been, you know, this spectacular advocate for a lot of things that you care about. But what you don't maybe not know is that it was his work with the Stanley Foundation that created the first national brain bank for bipolar, schizophrenia, and depression. And that provided tissue to hundreds of scientists around the world for free. And the only deal was that they had to send the data back so the data could now be collected and provided to the whole world's research community. That was exactly the right idea. I just wish that the government had had it at the same time. It took us another 15 or 20 years to realize the importance of that. We are now doing that 15 years later. But what we're finding is that there's not enough tissue out there, that we are going to need to develop the campaign. And we've done this at different NAMI meetings. We've actually had this conversation before, to get organ donation on the organ that nobody wants to give up because we think of it as ourself. And yet, until we get brain tissue, we're not going to be able to answer a lot of the really vital questions about brain disorders. So it's a great question and one I think we want to pursue with NAMI and others. We're doing this actually already with the autism community. So Autism Speaks, Simons Foundation, NIH are working together to get brains from both children and adults with autism. We need to do it with NAMI to have the same sort of conversation and the same sort of campaign. The other piece around three-dimensional sort of cell models, it's a brand new thing, very exciting, the idea that you could create sort of neurons in a dish or brain circuits in a dish in three dimensions. Fantastic area of science. Very early on, first papers just coming out this summer, and I think over the next few years you'll see that that's a great way to actually understand what's going on at the cellular level with these illnesses. Mike?
Hi. Mike Cohen, Amherst, New Hampshire. First of all, I want to thank you for a brilliant speech and your leadership at NIMH.
So I have to say, Mike's one of our partners, so that's like an inside job here.
My question relates to the Naples and Ray's interventions. You talked early on in your talk about the importance of quality and that the need for that, and it's not just access to services. So even if we have the Ray's study and Ray's sites and we have Naples sites, how do we know we're going to get the quality we really need? And us as advocates, and that's what NAMI is really about, what can we do to assure that we get the quality that we need?
So this is a great question, and it's maybe a fifth inconvenient truth that we don't want to talk about. We don't have an FDA for most of what we care about here, right? There's no FDA for psychosocial treatments. There's no FDA for supported employment, family psychoeducation. Go down the list. For psychotherapy, there's no regulatory framework for that. So, I said CBT is really, it looks really promising for people who are at high risk. But what prevents anybody from putting up their shingle to say, I can do CBT for this group, even though they have no idea what they're doing? And we won't get the competence that Kay Jamison talks about. So that is a problem we have to think about very carefully with you guys. I don't like the idea of creating a new regulatory agency. I guess that's one way to think about this. But this happened 100 years ago. I mean, it's really fascinating. Go back in the history of how did we get the FDA. In the 1910-1915 period, there was a lot of snake oil salesmen around that were applying their wares for various chemicals to treat all kinds of things in medicine. And it was when, with the emergence of something that looked like it really worked, that people said, wait a minute, we got to know what's good, what's garbage. And they created the FDA to provide that guidance about what's good, what's garbage, and give us a stamp of approval for what's good. We're kind of at that stage, right, for psychosocial treatments. We have stuff that really works. What we haven't done is to provide the regulatory framework for that so that any consumer would say, oh, this is the good stuff, that's the snake oil. And the guild agencies, the guild organizations like the American Psychiatric Association, American Psychological Association, you might have hoped that they would want to do that. Actually, not so much, right? They're protecting members, and they have their own agenda. So we have to think about who will do that and how it will be done. We've called for an Institute of Medicine study on just this question, and we've asked for a very rapid turnaround. Those things usually take 2 years. We want this in 6 months. And others have joined with us to support this effort. So over the next few months, we want to get the Institute of Medicine to weigh in with some guidance about what should this look like and how could we develop that kind of quality control, just the thing you're talking about. But we need to get all of you thinking about this and advocating for something that will ensure that there is guidance, that there's good quality and not just access. So thanks for your question.
Thanks.
I'm Claire Minot from the wonderful state of Vermont that gave you Joyce Berland and Mary Ellen Copeland. There must be something in the water. I just want to mention that NAMI was one of the first states to have the RAISE program. Sandy Steingart is a psychiatrist in Burlington. She started it. She's also involved with Open Dialogue. She's been to Finland many times. So we are in the forefront. My question to this is, the RAISE around the state are going to be everywhere in every state. This is a pilot. How is continuing funding going to see this 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now?
I don't have an answer for that. It's a perfect question. It's the question I'm asking as well. The one option is to get CMS to realize that this is something that should be covered through Medicaid. But once you do that, it's not just, you know, you have to have someone who can fund the setup, because you need to create a workforce in each place that can actually provide all of the different pieces of that toolkit. And to go back to Mike's comment, you've got to make sure it's done with the fidelity that you want. So I think that it was brilliant and wonderful that Congress said that in 2014 the mental health block grant should be used for this. I'm still trying to find out what's going to happen in 2015. And I know you had your congressional day Thursday, and this is Saturday, and you're all going home again. So, but, you know, when you're at home, you can still have this conversation with people who represent you and help them to know that you thought it was a good idea in 2014. What about even expanding it going forward? And there are lots of conversations about this, but it's not yet determined exactly how this gets sustained. And of course, you were exactly right when you said this is a pilot. It is a pilot, and we want to make sure that it goes from pilot to actually full scale, because I should say we want to make sure first that we get the outcome data from the big RAISE trial that John Cain is doing. We'll have that in December, and then based on that, I think we'll know much more about how to implement. So thank you for your question. Mariah.
I'm Jane Joyner from Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm going to sort of follow along with questions about the future and have you look at your magic ball. But you indicate that science is definitely the way to advance in mental health. And, of course, funding is always important, as it is for treatment. So I'd like you to, if you would, comment upon the potential impact that you see of the profit motive organizations, insurance companies, things of that sort, on the delivery of treatment and the outcomes that we would see for mental health.
So just unpack that a little bit more in terms of when you say the insurance companies, I'm not sure I follow the connection between that and the funding.
Okay.
Piece.
You need funding for scientific research.
Right.
For consumers to access treatment, they need funding. And if you get that through private pay or third-party insurance companies with their business model focused on profit, they find ways to sort of get around and achieve their objectives, perhaps at the detriment of the consumer.
Well, so I see your point now. I think what we have to realize is that when we do research on developing new treatments, the goal can't be to do what actually has happened increasingly in cancer. The goal can't be to create higher tech, higher cost interventions with very marginal gains. And what I am so excited about with RAISE and Naples and all these things that are happening with our highest cost disorders like the psychotic illnesses, is that these are not high-tech, high-cost interventions, and they should have an enormous savings for everybody. So I think we have, this is one of those rare opportunities where you can align everybody's interests if you do it right. But doing it right is not that simple. And that's what these last two questions have been about, is how do you make sure it gets done in a way that's going to work? And how do you, because they require some investment up front, how do you convince people that it's worth spending $8,000 per subject to save $50,000 next year? And you'd think that would be a really easy calculus to make. But if you're only in your job for a year, and this is, you know, you're working with this year's budget, and you're a state administrator, or you're even working in an insurance environment, that's not that easy to make that calculus. So those are the kinds of, I mean, I think there's some work to be done there, but I think in some ways we're better off than we would be if I were giving you the talk about developing the next whiz-bang drug for pancreatic cancer that gives you 20 days more survival and it costs $100,000 a year. That's really a harder discussion to have. So thanks.
Hello, doctor. My name is Rhonda Lee from New Orleans, Louisiana. And first of all, I want to thank you for sharing your knowledge with all of us. It was very appreciative, especially to me. On a personal note, my loved one was on lithium for over 10 years. We found out after that lithium stresses the kidneys. My loved one had to go on dialysis for a couple of years. I did donate my left kidney to my mother. But my question is, in your research, how much of this is going to data will be gathered from underdeserved populations, mm-hmm. diverse communities? And also, in your therapy, the model with the family, not leaving the parents out, please don't leave the children out either. Yeah. we are caregivers as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. Thank you. That's a great point to make. And the research that we do at NIH always has this focus on two things, on diversity. That is, we want to make sure that the science that we have is informed by this incredibly diverse population that we have, because we represent the entire United States, and this country is changing so quickly. So we want to have this sense of bringing in all these different populations, and we either fund people or supplement people to do that. But we also are focused on disparities and realizing that as income inequality becomes an even bigger issue than it already has been in this country, and it's becoming the, I think, will be the issue for the next decade in this country, we have got to focus on people who are, for whom access and whom treatment is going to be most difficult to provide. Worth remembering that at the National Institutes of Health, where we talk about, we are always talking about health disparities, and we usually mean by that the fact that for the treatment of hypertension, African Americans are at much higher risk, and they get much worse care, and they have much worse outcomes. I'd like to, you know, get NAMI on board saying that if you're really looking for a huge health disparity, one that's greater than any racial or ethnic disparity in the United States, just start looking at people with serious mental illness. You want to find a, you know, it is true that African Americans die earlier than white people in this country, that there is a disparity in longevity, but it doesn't hold a candle to the disparity in longevity for those with serious mental illness versus those without. And we got to recognize that, and we've got to be able to, you know, be very clear that that's just as important as these other health disparities as well. So thanks for your question. Yeah, last question. I'm sorry, but Ken tells me we can't go on forever. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Leslie Shanker from San Gabriel Valley, NAMI in Southern California. My question, I'd like you to comment on methylation determination and balancing, and if that is something we know enough about to take N-acetylcysteine or other antioxidants.
Okay, yeah.
And also, if knowing these things, that information can be spread. For instance, we know already that early influenza during a pregnancy is a high risk factor for schizophrenia. People were advised to wash their hands or, you know, wear gloves when they're pregnant. I don't know. These are the kind of things that would do a lot of good and don't cost a lot of money.
Yeah, so great question. There's a lot of things going on out there, everything from genomic sequencing to methylation to oxidative measurements. And the science just doesn't support any of that yet. Mm-hmm. Important to distinguish those things that are interesting research questions versus those that are really actionable and ready for clinical practice. And I would put all of those things into the research question bucket and say that you shouldn't spend money on something for which we don't yet have the best evidence. So Ken is telling me that we probably have to wrap this up. I'm hoping, because there's still questions left over, you guys will invite me back next year.
Really?
Dr. Insall has an open invitation.
All right.
To the Army Convention.
Okay. Thank you.
Just the information, Jill Bolte Taylor is not here this year. The Harvard Brain Bank is the where the singing scientist typically tells you she wants your brain, but she's in no hurry, which is always a positive. All right, one last show of love for Dr. Tom Insall.